Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
I'd like to welcome everyone in the audience to the Bay Area Book Festival's panel on the business of brutality, slavery, and the foundations of capitalism. And we want to thank everyone who's here for coming this afternoon. The weather's a little overcast, but we know this room is just going to light up in just a few minutes with all of the wonderful information you're going to get from this fabulous panel and your fabulous questions as well. We'd like to begin by reminding you to please turn off the volume on your cell phones, if you would do that. And my name is Jennifer King, and I'm delighted to be your moderator this afternoon. We're going to begin by acknowledging our sponsor today, and this would be the Stephen M. Silberstein Foundation. And we are delighted. We are delighted that Mr. Silberstein is here in the audience, and we want to acknowledge you for being here, and thank you again. The festival's been wonderful, and we know this session's going to be wonderful, and thank you for your kindness in sponsoring it. So what the format that I'd like to use this afternoon is I'd like to introduce each speaker and give them a little time to give you an overview of their book and how their book ties into our theme of the business of brutality. And beginning to my immediate right is Caitlin Rosenthal, and Caitlin is a professor of history at UC Berkeley. Please join me in welcoming Caitlin Rosenthal.
Thank you so much for the introduction. So I want to tell you a tiny bit about my new book, Accounting for Slavery, which is perhaps the most immediately connected to the title of the session, The Business of Brutality, because the book is literally about business practices. It's an attempt to write slavery back into American business history. There's a management scholar named Bill Cook who's basically argued that there's been a denial of slavery in management studies, that if you go back to look at the practices that slaveholders use, you can find most of the most important milestones in the history of American business. So what I've done in the book is take a business history approach going through a series of innovations that are typically identified with things like railroads and steam engines and all the typical places we talk about the emergence of American capitalism. And instead, I find these on slave plantations, both in the American South and also in the British West Indies. So, for example, the book moves through practices like the history of appreciation and depreciation. I follow an accountant who describes telling American planters that they need to appreciate and depreciate the enslaved people who are laboring on their plantations. And when you look at planters' account books, you can see them bringing minute detail to this kind of accounting. For example, there's a planter named James Green Carson who describes a formula for appreciating enslaved children. When they're born, they're valued at $25. If they survive to a year, $75. And then every year until they're 10 years old, they increase $25 per year. From there, you're supposed to track their value in relationship to the market. So it's a mix between like straight line appreciation and mark-to-market accounting. Very sophisticated when we think about it in the context of business practices. And then as people get older or ill or injured, they're depreciated. So the planters can track the value of enslaved capital much as they track the value of their other investments. To give just one other example from the book, you see planters grading enslaved lives in practices that are eerily similar to the way people graded bushels of grain on, for example, the Chicago Board of Trade. So they have to figure out how to make one bushel of grain comparable to another, and they try to do the same for enslaved people who they're attempting to trade. So one of the ways they do this, for example, is to price enslaved children by height. And the advantage of pricing by height is that it's much harder to contest. An enslaved person could object to their age. They can enter themselves into the calculation and make kind of their own influence known, but with height, the buyer and the seller could verify without the consent of the person. So I go through things like the organizational chart, management hierarchy, productivity analysis, and show that planters used lots of these. This isn't an account of average practices. I sometimes say it's like the Carnegies and the Rockefellers of the plantation conflicts, the people who we would have already been celebrating if not for the horrifying nature of their business. And the goal of all of this is really two things. First is to reshape the way we talk about management and the way we talk about American capitalism. We're used to creating narratives where innovation and technology, creativity go hand in hand with everybody getting better off. And this is a story where violence and innovation were, to borrow a business buzzword, synergistic, where they work together and planters reap the profits. And I hope that by taking this lens, we can kind of back up to see coercion and its role in American capitalism more clearly, both on the slave plantation and elsewhere. The second big goal of the book is to have a more adequate account of what enslaved people were up against. Did it mean to be an enslaved person attempting to survive the plantation complex? And studying the violence of the South tells you part of that story, but you can only fully understand what people faced once you understand that violence was married with like information systems, with modern surveillance practices, and with business practices that turn it into a violent plantation machine. So to see what enslaved people were up against, we have to understand the sophistication of plantation business practices. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker is also a professor here at the University of California in Berkeley, Stephanie E. Jones, and she'll be talking about her book, They Were Her Property. Please welcome. I'm sorry, that's a hyphenated name, Stephanie, forgive me. That's Stephanie Jones Rogers. Stephanie Jones Rogers.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. And just a quick thank you to all of you for coming this afternoon on a beautiful Sunday when you could have been doing many more things with your times. Thank you so much for coming too. So this book is really trying to foreground the experiences and the testimonies of formerly enslaved people. So in the 1930s, the federal government, some of you may know, the federal government wanted to put unemployed people back to work in as many ways as possible. And so they created the Federal Writers Project, which put to work unemployed authors and writers who then were charged with going throughout the country and trying to identify as many formerly enslaved people who were still alive as they possibly could to then ask them about their experiences in slavery. And so we have access to these interviews that they did. And so those interviews really, I think, helped to foreground the experiences of formerly enslaved people. And so what this book does is it draws on those interviews and foregrounds the experiences and the testimonies of formerly enslaved people to answer the question how did white, married, slave-owning women invest economically in the institution of slavery. And so what I do is I talk about the ways in which white girls, even in infancy, are crafting and cultivating identities that are intrinsically tied to the promise of or the actual eventuality of slave ownership. And over the course of their lives, I show in this book that they are profoundly and deeply invested in the economy of American slavery. And by looking to what formerly enslaved people had to say about married women's economic investments in slavery, I'm able to craft this story that does in fact show how these relationships, these economic investments evolve over the course of their lives and over the course of time, and particularly into the Civil War. And so it also shows that when we think about the Civil War and we think about white Southern women's responses to the Civil War, those responses are typically in our imaginings, emotional, sentimental, sentimental and even ideological responses to the Civil War. But by looking at what formerly enslaved people had to say about these women's economic investments in their continued subjugation and captivity, I was able to reveal a very different kind of source for those responses, an economic source. So what the book shows is that women, over the course of their lives, typically are given formerly enslaved people rather, more often than they are any other form of property or wealth. When you think about that in the context of the Civil War, what you realize is that many of these women are in fact responding to the war because they're losing so many of their loved ones. But what they're also responding to is the loss of the wealth that is bound up in enslaved people. And so by, again, foregrounding the experiences of formerly enslaved people and enslaved people, I'm able to tell an economic history of married women's investments in the institution of slavery in this book.
Thank you, Stephanie. And our final panelist, and certainly not the least, is Professor David Blight. And Professor Blight is a professor of history at Yale University, and if I have my information correctly, a very recent winner of the Pulitzer Prize in History.
Which doesn't qualify me to talk about capitalism, as you all, being the recipient of such a commercially important prize. Anyway, never mind. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, Caitlin, Stephanie, for inviting me onto this panel. I actually am not. There are lots of American and other historians now of this nexus of capitalism and slavery. It's been a booming resurgence of a field that you two are now landing in the middle of with these brilliant new books. My book is, of course, a biography of Frederick Douglass, and I'm not going to talk about that book hardly at all. Douglass, in fact, we can come back to this if somebody wants to in Q&A, was not a very visionary economic thinker. He was a very visionary political thinker. There are no less than three books now on Douglass as a political theorist, especially his embrace of and his prophetic advocacy of the natural rights tradition, of enlightenment natural rights tradition. Douglass ultimately saw most issues and problems in political terms. He saw most solutions in political terms. He saw the vote as by far the most important revolution and transformation that emancipation brought about in the Civil War. Doesn't mean he wasn't interested in land redistribution. Doesn't mean he wasn't interested in economics. He made the disastrous choice to be the last president of the failing Freedmen's Bank in 1874, a blunder he didn't even know at first he was walking into. It failed on his watch. That's another story. But I thought I might just do a very quick overview, just to get us started, and I know my colleagues will dive in here. Both of my colleagues here have written books that dive deeply into these questions of what a business slavery really was, and its management methods that operated this business. And Stephanie is showing us this world of ideas and sentiments and reactions and counter-reactions between the enslaved and their enslavers, around what it just meant to be property, what it meant to be gifted with property, what it meant to be property, what it meant to lose property, which we should never lose sight of. But this question of slavery's relationship to capitalism is very, very old among historians. This goes back to a long time ago. We sometimes date it with the so-called Eric Williams thesis, the great Caribbean British Empire historian Eric Williams, who argued in no uncertain terms, and I'm simplifying here, that slavery and the slave trade were the engine of the Industrial Revolution. Now, that's one of the first great questions that scholars went after a long time ago and have debated over and over and over, and people have landed on both sides of this over the years and still do. was the slave trade over its four centuries, and then plantation slave systems in the Americas, especially through those commodities of sugar and cotton, the root of the Industrial Revolution as it took place, as it took root in Great Britain in the late 18th century, and then in America in the 19th century, and for that matter, India. Indian cotton was far more important than before American cotton. That's one great question. There have been all kinds of answers on all sides of it. The second great question that historians have been fighting over for years, and it's kind of a dead-end debate in a way, and that is whether plantation slavery itself was capitalist. Whether these plantations, whether chattel slavery, especially in the big money crop agricultural systems of the American South, was essentially a capitalist system. Were slaveholders good capitalists, or were they pre-modern, feudalistic, backward-looking people who didn't understand markets or didn't understand the modernizing elements of capitalism? Most historians now conclude that, yes, they were good capitalists. You bet they were. And yes, they understood markets. No, they didn't understand as widely or broadly as they perhaps should have the importance of railroads, the importance of creating their own credit and banking systems, of not becoming so dependent on New York City and northern merchants for their wherewithal, their hoes and their tools and their clothing for their slaves. Yes, they might have been more far-seeing on that, but yes, they were great capitalists. I'll just throw out a couple other ideas there, just to frame this for a minute. If you really want to see to the heart of American slavery, you can find it in many, many ways, but one of them we learned a lot about in the last 25 years is the domestic slave trade. That's the system of transporting slaves from the Eastern Seaboard and the Upper South to the South, Deep South and Southwest. In the 40 years or so before the Civil War, a massive transit of approximately 1 million slaves, mostly over land, some by sea. If you want to see to the heart of just how capitalist slavery was, you look into books by a historian named Schermerhorn or a historian named Michael Tadman or Stephen Dealey and others who have now found a way to study these slave traders and their systems and their records. Slaves were utterly commodities of a speculative market. And just lastly, and I hope we will, and I suspect this will become a theme for us, we're deeply concerned about inequality today. I mean, I went to three sessions yesterday, one way or another. We're all about the problem of current, modern, racial and other forms of inequality in America, whether it's caused by Facebook or by corporate billionaires. Depends on which session you went to. And I'm sure some of you were at the same ones I was at. At any rate, you got to be careful drawing direct lines from a Mississippi planter of 1855 to Silicon Valley, or for that matter, General Motors. I grew up in Flint, Michigan, when General Motors was the Amazon of its time. You know, General Motors was supposed to be forever. It was forever. We just called it the company. They seemed to own everything. But inequality? 2/3 of the millionaires in the United States in 1860 were slaveholders. They were almost all in the lower Mississippi Valley. Half of them were in Mississippi. 2/3 of all millionaires in 1860 were slaveholders. And in 1860, if you don't know this number, this is one you can take out to your coffee clutches and your book clubs or your gym group or whatever and impress the people. Slaves in 1860 were worth approximately $3.5 billion as a financial asset. $3.5 billion. In today's money, it depends on which chart you look up and so on, but I don't know. You guys are the experts. It's probably in the neighborhood of $80 to $90 billion. today. And that was in an economy far smaller, and so on and so forth. $3.5 billion. It was the largest single financial asset in the entire American economy, worth more than everything else in the economy except the land. And I'm not sure anyone could ever value the land. It was the greatest liquid asset in the entire American economy. It doesn't explain everything about why the South would go to war, secede and go to war to defend this system, but it's got a lot to do with it. And I'll just make one last little point, and I think we'll probably come back to this too, I hope. The study of capitalism and slavery, like economic history generally, and I should read more economic history, clearly. I've been buried in trying to understand Frederick Douglass. And you know, I don't know if you feel this way, but going to lots of book festivals now, I really think audiences know far more about a lot more things than most of us authors do, because we've spent 6 to 10 years buried in one thing. And you guys read. We don't have time to read. So, but you can read some of the economic history of slavery. And I don't want to name any, not here, but I don't want to name any, even any of my colleagues, because I greatly admire this resurgence of this subfield of slavery studies. But you can read some economic history of, you know, cotton and capitalism and slavery, and sometimes the events just get lost. There's a thing called the Civil War in the middle of this. And, you know, you can read a lot of economic history of capitalism and slavery where you hear a lot about the merchant capitalists of the South, these slaveholders who got to know their markets, and the industrial capitalists of the North who were developing an industrial kind of capitalism, and these two great forces were coming into conflict. But it's worth remembering what historian Jim Oakes wrote recently. He said, you know, it wasn't merchant capitalists who seceded from the Union. It was slaveholders who seceded from the Union. And they made it amply clear in their secession resolutions and all their arguments for it. Yes, they were protecting a capitalist system worth $3.5 billion, make no mistake. But they were also trying to protect a racial system of slavery and its future. So there are a lot of ways to frame this problem of slavery and capitalism. I suspect most of you came here to hear another good critique of capitalism than you did the history of slavery, so we might as well get back to that.
Thank you, David. And thank you for giving us what I think is a good segue into a question that I'd like to ask Catlin. And Catlin, that's this. Very often you hear that during the antebellum South, that everything is slow, everything is moving at a snail's progress, and business is backwards. And only progress and innovation is occurring in the North. And would you talk a little bit about that myth?
So, you know, when I started this research project, I didn't intend to write a book about slavery. I was interested in the history of data. And I started looking at the account books of Northern textile mills. And then a year or so into my research, I got a copy of a plantation record and account book. And I was amazed that not only was it more detailed, it was more complexly filled out, and the calculations were more sophisticated than a lot of the northern account books. And it's because I was so steeped in that set of expectations about what the South and the North would look like. And that set of expectations has followed me everywhere I've gone in this research, because when I talk to people, you get one of two responses when you say you're writing a book about the business history of slavery. One is that people are totally shocked, because they haven't even thought that slavery would have a business history. So when you start to point out all the things that planters were doing, they're really surprised. And then the other possibility is that people say, well, of course, didn't we already know that? Or, you know, knowing what I know about slavery, they must have been doing that. So it's like the distance between these two sets of expectations that I think shows the persistence of this mythology about the South being backwards. And you know, economic historians have shown that Southern planters were innovators. I write about data practices and accounting, but they've also shown, for example, that they're sophisticated in biological innovation. That is, they invest in finding the best new varieties of cotton, and they're figuring out how those can be made the most pickable for the hands of enslaved people to reach into them and pluck out the cotton. Not only that, you know, they're not so good at railroads, but they have huge investments in steamships. And as Professor Blight pointed out, the amount of invested capital is huge. It's more than is invested in factories. And so once you, Alfred Chandler's Visible Hand, the most important book in American business history, says, you know, the planters were sophisticated, but, you know, they just didn't have that much capital. And then you go to his footnotes, and it turns out he subtracted all the enslaved people from his calculations of capital. Jeez. And once you realize that they're thinking about the choreography of the labor of enslaved people in not too different of a way than Northern manufacturers are thinking about machines, and they've got as much money invested in them, then it starts to make a lot of sense how deeply slavery is entrenched in not just the history of America, but the history of American innovation and American capitalism.
Thank you for that.
You've actually stated that white women may have constituted up to 40% of all slaveholders in the South. Tell us what you think about how American slavery might have been different or changed in any way had these women actually been the majority of slaveholders.
Well, so let me just explain how I got to this, to the point where I would even feel the need to come up with a figure. So when I present my research at various events, one of the questions that I often get is, well, it sounds like you're talking about some rare, exceptional women. So how many of these women were there? And so previously, prior to the work that I've been doing with the data, James Oakes, a historian of slavery in America, he estimated that women constituted 10% of all the slaveholders in the United States. And so I was really intrigued by that and thought, well, let me look a little deeper. Let me dig a little deeper. So I started to look at a series of different data sets, mainly the census records from 1850 and 1860. And what's really interesting is that 1850 is really a really different year for the census, in large part because prior to 1850, the census, the Bureau of a federal census, did not collect information systematically on the number of enslaved people that lived in the country. So in 1850, somebody thought it might be a good idea to know just how many enslaved people lived in the country. And so they started to identify slaveholders in that year as well in 1850. So they would identify the slaveholder and then simply enumerate, list how many enslaved people that particular slaveholder identified as theirs, as having legal title to. So I started to look at the census data to try to identify just how many women appeared in the census data. And so I was finding all these women, looked at smaller data sets in places like Charleston and South Carolina, more broadly in Louisiana and in DC. And what I was finding was that they were numbering far more than 10% of those slave owners. In fact, in those areas and in my preliminary quantitative data, they are constituting in the 40% range. And this is not unusual, in large part because other historians, Catherine Hall, who looks at slaveholders who when Britain decided to abolish slavery and compensate slaveholders for the slaves that they lost as a consequence of that, she's looking at all those individuals who applied for compensation. And she, too, found that women constituted 40% of the applicants to the British Parliament. So this is a really, I think, interesting pattern across the board. And so when thinking about the fact that not only, as I mentioned in my opening comments about the book, not only are women receiving far more slaves than any other form of property from childhood over the course of their lives, not only are they invested in those ways, but they're also receiving, often receiving more slaves than their husbands are, than the men in their lives are in some cases, who are often getting land. When you think about how deeply invested they are in slave ownership in that way, then it leads me to believe, particularly when you look at the actions generations of slave-owning women in the Civil War period and then after the Civil War period, that they would certainly not be at the forefront of the abolitionist movement. They would not be signing up to abolish slavery and set everyone free if there was no compensation at the end of that process. So for me, I think if women were, in fact, the majority, and they're pretty close to almost, you know, like 50-50 here, that slavery would look very much the way it did with men being in the majority, in large part because formerly enslaved people talk about how deeply invested these women were in the economy of slavery, the ways in which they bought and sold enslaved people, the ways in which they profited from hiring enslaved people that they owned out and receiving their compensation for that work. So there were all of these various ways that women were invested economically in the institution. And when we think about their relationships as economic in basis, then it makes it clear that they would certainly not be at the forefront of, it, of a full-blown emancipation movement if it didn't come to civil war.
Great, thank you. David, both Catlin and Stephanie in their books share with us the fact that enslaved people were aware of the business surrounding them and how valuable they were to the planters. Would you share with us a little, what do you think Douglass knew about his value as human capital?
Well, thanks for that question. Actually, it does give me a great chance to talk about Douglass. Yeah, for any of you who have actually read his first narrative, the first autobiography, you may remember his descriptions, long, rich descriptions of the Y House, the Y Plantation, which was the largest slave operation in all of Maryland, owned by a man named Colonel Edward Lloyd. And this is his remembrance of the conditions on that huge operation, writing it when he was 27 years old, but he remembers it as an industrial operation. He describes everything from the blacksmith shops to the carriage houses and the horse operation to the many layers of overseers. He has these incredible descriptions of what he called allowance day, which was the day once a month that all the slaves on the outlying Lloyd farms would come into the big house. He called it the great house farm and get their monthly supplies of flour and meal and sometimes clothing and other commodities they needed. He shows what a kind of factory that great Y Plantation was. And that was not a cotton operation. There was no cotton in that area of the eastern shore of Maryland. There was tobacco. That was their big cash crop. But actually, they made a cash crop out of wheat and corn, which we forget about. And so much of the Upper South, wheat and corn, grains, were a cash commodity for the market. And in the plantation he was on, it backed up right onto the Chesapeake Bay. It backed onto a little river that went into the Chesapeake Bay. So his remembrance of his childhood amidst all of this, and he talked about the noises and the sounds of a big operation like this, with as many as 200 to 250 visible slaves in and around just the Y Plantation itself, not even talking about the outlying farms. And you can't miss it. You know, he's describing a massive, he didn't use the word capitalist, but a massive kind of capitalist operation producing for markets way beyond, way out that Chesapeake Bay, out for another world somewhere. It was also self-sufficient, which is important to note here. The American plantation system, it's very different from the Upper South to the Lower Mississippi to, you know, Upper Florida and the Sea Islands of Georgia, South Carolina, and so on. But what we have learned from a lot of the economic history of slavery is that the American plantation system was, to a great extent, self-sufficient. It produced what it needed. It produced its own food. By and large, it produced even a lot of its own tools, although they tended to buy a lot of that material from northern merchants. So, but also I'd say this, Douglass so many times in his lyrical ways whether it's in the first two autobiographies or whether it's in eventually speeches, for that matter, even editorials in his newspaper, he had a way of penetrating to the core of what it meant to be property, what it meant to be held as property, what it meant to have your body owned. And he frequently wrote about this issue in his remembrance of the difference between slavery's damage or hostility to the body versus the mind. And he would frequently say that his greatest fear was what slavery could do to his mind, that it would control his mind, that it would control his imagination, that it would control any creative urge that he might have. As opposed, you know, he would say, you know, they can keep damaging my body, perhaps, but it's his mind he worried about the most. And I do think that links up to so much of what we've learned about workers generally, laborers generally, over the centuries, from peasantry to modern industrial wage laborers who have to find a way to preserve their psyche in the face of this commodification of their time, their bodies, and their work that, in the case of a slave, they have almost no control over. And he also gives us those moments when he remembers losing any control, like when he's rented out to a particularly brutal overseer who beats the bejesus out of him every week, and how he kind of lost the will to resist, to live, to function. That's a story that connects, I think, to the whole history of what we might call brutalized labor. There's a thousand other things one could say here about Douglass's remembrance of being a slave. And he also observed so many other slaves who were, in effect, wrecked by the system. By wrecked, I mean they just didn't care, they didn't function well, they didn't resist. This idea that all slaves just got up every day to figure out how they could resist the master, yeah, how many of us would have been all that good at it every day, just living for resistance? The average human being gives in to brutalization, usually. That's why it works.
Okay. Thank you for that. Another great segue, David. Providing the segues this afternoon, that's great. Both of you have talked about slaves, enslaved people who did resist in various and sundry ways. So, Catlin, would you share with us in terms of the planters trying to quantify everything, and how did that script get flipped every once in a while?
So this is a case where, following Stephanie, I've also tried to incorporate enslaved narratives to find out how they're pushing back against the account books. And there's an amazing narrative from Israel Campbell. This is not one of the ones that Steph talked about. This is a published narrative. But he describes in it the brutality of the picking regime and how every day planters would weigh the amount of cotton that every enslaved person picked on the plantation. And there's enslaved people were in charge of that calculation and the weighing process, and sometimes they weighed the cotton as many as three times a day. So you would know not only what your target was, but how you were doing against that target. And there are slave narratives that say that if you fall short, you will be punished for falling short. But Israel Campbell describes how, in the process of picking, he's on a plantation, and he just can't pick fast enough. And so his strategy is to stuff other stuff inside these bags of cotton. It's a good strategy. And he gets away with it. He's able to make his targets. And there are also stories of people sharing cotton amongst themselves. Because just as much as you don't want to fall short, you don't want to go over. Because if you go over, then your target will go up. It's increasing. But Campbell, on the one hand, he gets away with it. On the other hand, he says, look, the planter is weighing every enslaved person every day. And then the cotton gets ginned, and you have a ratio, which is called the turnout ratio, between the ginned cotton and the picked cotton. And it's not always exactly the same, but they know about how much they should get. And he says at the end of the season, he's ginned all the cotton, and he knows that there's a shortfall. Like something's been happening that Campbell has been resisting. And they don't ever recover the source of that resistance, but of course they have to give up the strategy because the calculations have come around at the end to show that he's being policed. So this is a kind of, I think it shows him resisting. It shows how the numbers create a more sophisticated system that prevents that resistance. It also shows the stakes of that small-scale resistance, how important it was to have the equivalent of a slowdown on the plantation to keep the planter from knowing the maximum amount of cotton that enslaved people could pick.
Stephanie, would you talk a little bit about the white woman's involvement in our panel topic, the business of brutality? We want to think of the Southern Belle as docile and quiet and very, very gentle. But there's another story there, and would you share that a bit?
Sure. So there was a gentleman, Tom Hawkins, who was owned by a woman named Annie Poor. And so much of the scholarship on women's relationships to the slave market, to the market in which African Americans were bought and sold, is often one that says they weren't connected, that they did not have at least a direct relationship to the market in enslaved people. And so what Tom Hawkins talks about in his account of his mistress, Annie Poor, is that she was very much a savvy businesswoman who was directly tied to the market, because what she did was she would train enslaved people to be the kind of laborers who she knew would yield a certain price in the market. And not only would she do that, but then she would actually hold slave auctions on her estate and sell those enslaved people who she had trained. She built a slave auction block for her yard, in her yard, in order to hold slave auctions. She was savvy because not only does this mean that she had to be tapped into the market, and she had to know the prices that certain kinds of laborers would yield in the market, but she also had to know what would be necessary to equip them with the skills necessary to qualify as those laborers. So in all of these various ways, she was not only a slave owner or an enslaver, but she was a slave auctioneer, she was a slave trader, and in many ways, so she benefited from all these various ways in which engaging in market activities would benefit anybody. So that's one really important example. Another one, which I think reflects the ways in which sexual violence is often interconnected with the business of slavery and the brutality of slavery, is a woman named Emily Haiti, who owned a woman named Henrietta Butler. And Henrietta Butler talks about the ways in which her mistress would force her to have sexual intercourse with other enslaved men on the plantation. So essentially orchestrating acts of sexual violence. And once those acts of sexual violence, once those pairings, those forced pairings produced children, Emily Haiti, her mistress, would keep the girls and sell the boys, with this idea that she would continue to force these females to have sex against their will and produce heirs, produce children, and as a consequence of the sexual violence. So there's a way in which, even within the context of sexual violence, these women are calculating the economic bottom line. And so they turn, in this case, sexual violence into a business, into a commerce. And one third example that I talk about in the book is this phenomenon that I've only found in New Orleans at this point, but there were what were called Negro brothels. And so there were white women who owned slaves who were also brothel owners who would purchase enslaved women for the specific and sole purpose of engaging in sexual labor, sexual slavery. And so this was a really savvy move on their part, because what it meant was that these women could be sold, their bodies could be sold over and over again for a profit, over and over again without depreciating the value of those bodies. So there are all these various ways in the book that I talk about the ways in which women are deeply connected to the business of slavery, that they were in fact fundamental to the business of slavery. There are even some women who were slave traders that I talk about in the book, who made a living, profited from the purchase and sale of enslaved people as a business, and they were part of these family businesses. The woman, Matilda Kendig Bushy, who was the aunt of a very notorious slave trader in New Orleans, and he was notorious in large part because he would buy enslaved people who were unwell and claim that they were healthy, and then he would get a profit from that. And so she, in fact, was involved in this business too, and she would do the same thing even long before he did. So there are a variety of ways in which women were deeply invested in the business of brutality, the business of slavery, in the formal ways that we think about, but also in these very informal ways that often escape our notice because they might not appear in the archival documents that historians often use, the sources that we often use to tell those stories.
Can I jump in with a footnote?
Please.
I mean, one of the remarkable things about both of these books is they have so many real people in them. This isn't just about economic forces and account books, although Southern Bells could keep good account books, couldn't they? There's so many real people, as you just heard, in these books, names. It's not impossible to find real people in the record of slavery. And just one footnote that goes right to the top of the story. Some of you perhaps have been to Monticello, Jefferson's home. Mm-hmm. They've really, really revised very positively how they now portray slavery at Monticello. I was once on their board that sort of advised on this. But one of the things you can learn at Monticello now is that Mr. Jefferson was so deeply interested in the labor of his slaves in a host of ways, but he had a nailery out on Mulberry Row. That's the long row of what used to be buildings and cabins next to Monticello, the house. And at the nailery, which was the little operation, this little kind of industrial operation where they made nails, which were so important, you know, in 18th and early 19th century farming. But Jefferson figured out that the best workers in making these nails were boys from about the age of 10 to 14, because apparently they have more dexterous fingers in those years. And he would put them in there and keep very careful records of exactly what they were producing. But apparently when they got to be 14 and 15, I don't know, maybe they lost interest, but they weren't as good anymore. Detailed records of the production in that nailery by individual names, and so again you see this deeply commodified nature of production. I just want to throw one other thought out there, and then maybe I would love to hear the two of you reflect on it, and maybe others here. I wonder how surprised any of you are at all this. It's possible you're greatly surprised. I don't know. A lot of really good and seemingly well-meaning people sold a lot of bad mortgages 10 years ago and sent our economy nearly into a death knell. We can think of all kinds of business practices throughout history by some seemingly well-meaning people. And the problem in this, one of the problems in the study of this subject has always been, just how do you evaluate evil? You know, these people they're farmers. They're capitalists, they're farmers. They inherited their situation in most cases, although some of them were first generation slave owning entrepreneurs who went from Georgia out to Alabama to Mississippi to get more land, more slaves, more land, more slaves, just like Thomas Sutpen and William Faulkner's Absalom. But where do you find a way to talk about the essentially evil character of this business, and then when do you just describe the business? And how do you do the two together in an effective way that makes you a good historian, and not just somebody that's just beating you over the head every minute with the horror of this? Because you may not keep reading it if it's nothing but the horror. And yet the horror's got to be there. So how do you two, young scholars who've come to this field, maybe you're probably much more sophisticated than my generation was. I don't know. But how do you think about that?
Caitlin.
And then I'll step out the back door.
So I'll just say one thing, since you were talking about Jefferson. One, I was recently at Monticello, and I was always struck by how from his office and his account books, in one way Mulberry Row, where slavery was, is just around the corner. And
right out
way,
the window.
It's totally out of sight. It's like both there and invisible at the same time. And these account books are a lot like that, where the data is all there. If you start to think about it, and you think, take the time to think about what's behind it, it's totally devastating. On the other hand, if you're just keeping your account books, if you're Jefferson, or maybe even better, if you're a absentee owner across the whole Atlantic Ocean, then you can keep this calculations and you don't have to think too hard about what's actually happening there on the ground. And certainly there were people who were right there on the ground who had to think about it every day and were in the midst of it, but a lot of what the data offered was distance. And I have an ambivalent reaction to this myself. I mean, sometimes I'm in the records and I just am seeing the horror, especially with children. I'm talking about, I remember I have two small children right now, and I remember reading an account book where a planter talked about ganging labor, so division of labor on the plantation. He had a special suckling gang for nursing women so he could control the schedule on which they nursed their children so they could go to the fields and the rest of the time. So sometimes you read these things and it's like, you're just like devastated. But then there's other times where I'm reading it and I'm following in their calculations and I'm horrified by the amount of distance that I'm able to have. And that distance lets me do the research, but the distance is also something to be really worried about. I mean, you said we can't draw a straight line to Facebook, but when we think about what data erases and the distance that data is offering modern capitalism and the way it allows us to talk about circumstances of production as totally separate from what we consume and what we spend our time, data offers a mediating factor that can make slavery visible and help us see the horror that was there, but it can also give us a comfortable separation.
So for me, this book is about formerly enslaved people. This is about their stories, their experiences. And in those interviews that I mentioned at the beginning of my comments, you know, what you have to realize is that they're doing this, they're giving these interviews, they're answering these very difficult questions about their experiences in captivity in some of the most tenuous, racially hostile, dangerous context that you can imagine. This is post-Civil War South, you know what I mean? So you can't really get more dangerous than that for a formerly enslaved person. And so for me, I don't psychologize, I don't pathologize the women who I talk about in this book. I let formerly enslaved people speak for themselves. And when you think about, well, when I thought about the fact that they sat in these really racially hostile, dangerous, and risky contexts, and they told these stories, and they said these things, and they talked about the horrors and the atrocities and the violence and the brutality, but also the love and the resilience and the survival of those experiences. For me, that suggested that they wanted these stories to be told the way they told them. They wanted us to understand what had been done to them. Not to sanitize it, not to whitewash it, and not to, you know, to judge. So I leave my readers to make their own judgments about the women that appear in this book. You read what formerly enslaved people had to say about them. You read what their experiences were like under these women's dominion, and you can make up your own mind about whether they were evil or whether they weren't evil. The words are there. This book is about them. It's not about, you know, my particular impression of these women's, you know, morals, et cetera. So I don't moralize. I just, you know, let the reader make up their minds, you know. And that's where I stand on that point.
All righty then.
Aren't they wonderful? And I know that we've only scratched the surface because we haven't heard from you yet. So now is the time. If you'd like to have a question, to ask a question. And because we are being filmed live on C-SPAN right now, we want the audience to hear you as well. So if you would please go to one of the staff people who has a microphone so that everyone in here and our C-SPAN audience can hear you as well. So the microphones, I believe, are all over there. Are there any mics on this side of the room?
Just here.
Just, I'm sorry, all the microphones, unfortunately, are in that side of the room. And I'm going to ask if you would ask a question and be succinct with it so that we could hear from as many of our folks in the audience as possible.
So first, thank you to all of you for the incredible books you've written and the thousands of hours that went into each one of your projects. Could you talk a little bit about the whole free soil ideology and where capitalism fit on both sides of the slavery equation as we were leading up to the Civil War? Free soil was kind of shocking to me. I always thought it was abolitionist, and would love to hear more about that.
David?
Well, it was abolitionist. I mean, part of the Free Soil Party that actually existed by 1848 were abolitionists. The Free Soil Impulse was the idea of keeping the West free from slave labor. It became the central core idea of eventually the Republican Party once it was founded in 1854. Free soilism, the idea of keeping the West cordoned off from slavery such that it could be settled by free labor, was arguably one of the most compelling coalition political notions in all of American history. I would just add to that that we do need to factor in here. I mean, this is back to the macro level. But the while slavery was evolving as we know now, a deeply capitalist system in the South in those 40, 50 years before the Civil War, a free labor ideology, as we've come to call it, was also evolving in the North. And I think it's a bad mistake to make to not take that dead seriously in the ways that it threatened slaveholders. That free soil, that anti-slavery coalition that's evolving politically by the 1850s really threatens slaveholders, because the aim of it is to cordon off the South, close it off, stop its expansion. And Southerners got terrified in economic terms. They got very, very worried about what they called a shrinking South, which meant a shrinking slave system. If slavery was cordoned off and it couldn't expand into the Kansas-Nebraska Territory, it couldn't expand into the Southwest, or if it couldn't expand into the Caribbean, which was always a big contested idea in the 1850s, they feared then that slaveholders in the Upper South would begin to sell off their slaves because the prices would go down. And the slaves would be sold into the Deep South, and the Deep South would become this increasing pressure cooker of a racial slave system on the verge of insurrection. And so this sense of a Southern kind of nationalist, ultimately secessionist ideology comes out of this idea that if we don't strike soon to preserve this system as we know it, it won't be here in 20 years. Because it's really... Now, we love to point out the racism of the Northern Republicans and the Northern Free Soilers, that they weren't always interested in the human rights of the slaves. That's true. But they really were interested in stopping the spread of slavery. Because if there was an American dream of antebellum America for all those immigrants and all those small farmers in this burgeoning economy, free labor economy in the North, that dream was to go west, get land, get it free, homestead it, and pass it on to your children. And if slavery gets there and gobbles up all the land with an oligarchy, you're not going to be able to do it. We make a mistake in not realizing just how different these two visions of the future really were. There's a reason the Civil War came about, and it wasn't just because of a bunch of fanatics. Sorry, that's a quick way of saying free soilism was very important.
good afternoon. Peace. My question is, just listening to you all this afternoon, I heard a difference in how you referred to either slaves or enslaved people. And so I was interested in what's at stake with using that, referring to people as enslaved or formerly enslaved and referring to them as being slaves. And then for Book TV, hi, Mom, I love you.
Stephanie.
Yeah.
Yes. So thank you for that question. I use the terms enslaved and formerly enslaved in large part because I think those terms reflect the fact that the institution of slavery imposed a status on African descended people, that this was not a status that they accepted. Fully, there were some, I would imagine some people would argue that they did in fact accept or embrace some form of their bondage, some elements of their bondage. But for me, what I see in the sources is this rejection of the status of slave. So for me, I use formerly enslaved and enslaved in large part to reflect the fact that they rejected that status that was imposed upon them. I'll also say that one of the new kind of more contemporary trend seems to be to refer to those who claim to hold legal title to slaves as enslavers, and I think that's a great trend. You might notice if you read the book that I refer to these women as slave owners, and I do that intentionally as well because I think if you look at what they had to say about ownership of enslaved people, they identified themselves as slave owners. For example, there's a woman who was in the original epilogue who she was at church, and so this guy, he's an abolitionist, he goes into the church and he wants to know if there are any slave owners there who he can talk to, and so she says, "I'll talk to you. I'm a slaveholder. I'm a slave owner, and I glory in it." Those were her terms. He did not ask her to say that. So she embraced it. And many of the women in this book embraced their status as slave owners. And so for me, the fact that the courts recognize their status as legal title holders to human beings is important to make clear. And I think using the term slave owner in the book is one of the reasons why I chose to use that term. But I do embrace the term enslavers, but not in my own work.
I agree with everything Steph said.
Well, I'll be slightly contrarian and old-fashioned. I understand the impulse to change our labeling, and we're always doing it. We've been doing this for years and years. But I do think it's worth reminding ourselves, with all due respect, that these are labels that are necessary for our time. They're not necessarily historical labels. All the slave owners is.
Yes.
Slave owners is. There's no question. Slave holder, slave owner, no question. Mm-hmm. We can beat our brains out sometimes, spending hours deciding what to call things and then not actually learn the history around it. That's my fear. Mm. Douglass called his narrative, Autobiography of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, written by himself. Mm-hmm. Harriet Jacobs called it Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, written by herself. They didn't embody the status of slave. They tried to destroy it. This will always be an issue, always will. Mm-hmm. But our debates about what to call things are usually about ourselves and not as much about the past. I know where the door is.
I want to thank you all for a wonderful discussion. And I heard Caitlin Rosenthal on the radio the other day discussing her book. And since I heard that, I'm not a historian, a lot of questions have gone through my mind. For example, it seems that I never considered before, the distinction between capital and labor seems in some sense to break down with the slave. And I also thought that, geez, you described that they made special whips so that they wouldn't leave scars because that would make a slave less valuable, less worthy in the less worth in the market. So it seems there are two things that struck me about that. Number one, and I'm sorry to go on like this, but number one is that the slave owner then had a bigger job than the industrial northerner who didn't have to care about his labor at all. It wasn't an investment. All he had to do was carry about the machinery. And number two, which is more specific, in terms of the value of the property, the slave, it would be a horrible thing for a slave owner to have disease race through his plantation, and also for the neighbors. Was there any attention paid to public health and infectious disease in that environment just as a business consideration?
So I'll just say a couple things about that. So there are plantations that employ a doctor or something like that. They're also the same book I described that had a suckler's gang, had a measles gang, so that people who had recovered from measles could get back to work as soon as they were able to even work at a slower pace. So they are definitely concerned with medicine. The other thing, though, I think, so we have this modern distinction between labor and capital. The economists say there's three inputs of production, land, labor, and capital. And one of the things that Planter's books show is how easy it was to triangulate between labor and capital and to think about enslaved people as both at the same time and to be strategic about that. And when you compare them to factory owners, on the one hand, they do have to consider many more things. Like they have to think about medical care, although factory towns in the north did that as well. But they also didn't have to deal with people quitting. When I look at northern account books, people are quitting everywhere. They, like, you have 100% turnover per year on a northern textile factory. And so you have to recruit people, you have to get them to stay, and planters don't have to do that. I mean, in a way, emancipation is about the freedom to quit. W.E.B. Du Bois calls the Civil War a general strike. It's like the withdrawal of labor and the freedom to quit was... So in the one way, management was harder for planters, but in another way, they had this huge problem of recruiting and maintaining labor massively simplified for them.
This might be an arbitrary connection, but I was struck by the numbers of 40% of women were slave owners and the statistic of white women who voted for Trump. And I was just wondering, also in the 40s...
Well, there's a parallel.
Yeah, if y'all could just speak about that. And, you know, the, like, white feminism versus intersectional feminism and just what's going on in parallel.
Boy. Well, I will say... Oh. I will say you're not alone in seeing those parallels, in seeing that connection, because I'm often asked about any kind of connections I can make to from the book to the present. And so what I like to say is you have to think about the fact that slavery is a system about racial discrimination. It is a racially discriminatory system, and these women are invested in that racially discriminatory system. They are also deeply invested in white supremacy. And they are deeply invested in white supremacy in the context of slavery, but after slavery is over, they are profoundly invested in white supremacy, not just in the ideology of white supremacy, but in the action, the act of racial terror. And so what you see is that women, after slavery is over, they are equally averse to this free labor system. They do not want to they are not willing to hire formerly enslaved people who they had once owned as free laborers. There's an example of a man who, you know, he contracts with his former female owner to work her land in exchange for a share of the crop at the end of the harvest. And so he comes for his share of the crop. She comes out with a gun and she tells him if he doesn't leave her land, she will blow his brains out. You know, so they are deeply invested in white supremacy. And so what you see is over the course of the 20th century, there are these moments in which these white women who are the descendants of these women, but who aren't maybe the descendants of these women, who are equally invested in white supremacy, who show that while we think of them as oppressed because of their gender, they are seeing the benefits of embracing white privilege fully. So the lynching rituals where you can see postcards even today where you can see white women and girls at these lynching rituals right below the bodies of the dangling bodies of lynched black men. You can see women at the forefront of the anti-integrationist movements of the 60s, both in the South and in the North. You can see them voting for Brian Kemp at 73% of them voting for Brian Kemp in Georgia. So there are ways in which I think this history that I tell in this book kind of lays a groundwork for trying trying to understand how, in moments in which we want to imagine that women, these women are oppressed because of gender, they are acting in their own best interests as white people. So they are, in fact, embracing white supremacy as a way around, as a way to circumvent some of the oppressive elements of being a woman.
We can take possibly two more questions and then we'll have to wrap it up.
I think you answered a lot of it just now already, so this question is for Dr. Jones-Rogers, but I was wondering, like, it was mentioned the stereotype of like the Southern Belle sort of not, like the idea that she doesn't have power, her husband has all the control, and then there's this statistic you found where it's like 40% of slave owners were women. And I'm wondering, like, why do you think this sort of discrepancy has persisted for so long, and what purpose has it served over time?
Almost immediately after slavery is over, what you begin to see is white women constructing narratives that absolve them. And I think that trend continues today. Again, we want to foreground gender oppression, but what you see is this pattern wherein some white women, not all, this is not certainly an indictment of all white women, because there are many wonderful white female allies, hopefully in the room too. But there are these moments in which some white women choose to embrace white supremacy because they understand that as women, they will face extraordinary oppression and extraordinary limitations and constraints on their autonomy. And so you see that in slavery, and you see that, I think, even in the present. So you see them constructing narratives that absolve them almost immediately after slavery is over. And I think we continue to grapple with those narratives, in large part because they are revised time and time again in ways that, again, absolve women, white women, from these kind of the kind of darkest elements of our nation's history and our nation's present.
Okay, thank you. I want to put it in very simple terms. If a bunch of white guys had not gone to Africa and stolen a bunch of black guys to bring them back for free labor, who would have done all that work? And if they weren't doing that work for money, then what else were they doing at that time?
I'm not sure. What
David?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Devaney.
What a surprise to do that.
You just simplified the origins of the slave trade a bit much. The slave trade came about because European societies with somewhat better technology encountered African societies with somewhat lesser technologies, but tremendous natural resources that they ended up trading for people. The slave trade was not just a bunch of white guys stealing a bunch of black guys. It was an enormous international business of commodities, exchanging over four centuries what one side had for the other and what the other side had for the other. Unfortunately, it became this massive, tragic transportation of the one commodity more than any others that Europeans wanted from Africa, and that was people for the new plantation economies of the Americas. Now, as to what they would have been doing had they not come to America, I don't know what to do with that, because they did. 12.5 million of them successfully were transported into the New World, the largest forced migration of human beings in history. And that is very much a capitalist cooperative arrangement between Europeans and Africans. And there's a tremendous literature on that that has explained it.
One.
I couldn't hear you.
Okay.
It went in Wakanda.
Please.
Yeah. Thank you for your lecture, and I have one simple question. Could you give me a brief something on slavery today in the prison industrial complex?
slavery in the prison industrial complex.
Well, I mean, so one thing I'm writing about right now about plantations is the role of surveillance on plantations, and the way that planters coerced enslaved people not only into labor but also into watching each other. And I think this, I mean, I'm not an expert on the prison industrial complex today, but when you follow the history of surveillance forward from slavery, you can certainly see origins of many aspects of the kind of policing and prison complex that we have today. I mean, one of my hopes is that by studying the history of slavery, we can see more vividly the role of control over people's movements and people's labor in the emergence of American capitalism. I mean, we don't talk a lot about control in the history of accounting, even though the top accountant is the controller. And control and violence and surveillance, certainly kind of some of the same systems are continuing to evolve. I also, though, I mean, as a historian of slavery, I think it is important a little bit to resist some of the comparisons. So I want to, the legacy is with us now and partly in that form. But we've also made some real important progress.
Prisons are economic systems. Prisons are major employers in many American communities around the country. As a lot of you, perhaps particularly rural areas, rural towns, prisons are the main employers. And I would just draw you to, I mean, yes, there are these links. No historical parallel or link or analogy is ever absolutely direct. That's just not the way history works. History is far messier than that. But there are parallels between the kinds of commodification, the kinds of control exercised in slavery and its aftermath in the South, in the sharecropping system, and then even in peonage, to our current incarceration, although our current incarceration came out of the latter 20th century by and large because of laws about drug use and drug possession, and you all know all that. But the one thing I'd draw your question to, if in case this is the last question, is let's not forget that there's a massive system of labor trafficking and human trafficking and forms of slavery existing right now that's bigger in sheer numbers, depending on how you're counting it, than the system of chattel slavery was in 1860. And current modern forms of either labor slavery or sex slavery and all the kinds in between are part of deeply capitalist systems where labor is necessary to produce all kinds of commodities that you and I use every day and hold them in our hands. That iPhone is made in something like 50 countries. And some of the laborers may not be free. So, I mean, wherever slavery has always existed, at least historically, where land is plentiful and labor is not plentiful. Slavery now exists where labor is not plentiful, but the demand for the commodities that we want to use in this modern, postmodern, whatever it is, economy, is endless and tremendous. And the human capacity to exploit people for production is as old as humanity. And it has not gone away. And if anything, it's probably grown. Boy, that's a bleak thing to end on.
Oh, I know we don't want it to end, but we really have to. So before you leave, we want to take a moment to thank our wonderful authors, Caitlin Rosenthal, and her book, Accounting for Slavery.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.